This is Tom Reber from the Strongpreneur Podcast, and in this episode, I talk with Amy Morin, a licensed clinical social worker and author of 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. Take back your power, embrace change, face your fears, and train your brain for happiness and success. Amy and I talk about the three components of mental strength, how to spot when you're being a mental weakling, and the difference between mental strength and mental toughness. If you like what you hear in the show today, please subscribe or leave a review on iTunes. And without further ado, here's Strongpreneur Amy Morin. When my wife sent me the article that you had published in Forbes, and she sent me a link to your website a few weeks ago, I knew that I had to have you on the Strongpreneur podcast because your article was entitled The 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. So I think it just made sense to invite you on. So I've been really looking forward to this over the last couple of weeks. So appreciate that. Before we dive in today and I pick your brain on some of this stuff, would you be willing to share a little bit about you and tell us who Amy is?
Sure. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the wonderful state of Maine, and I work as a therapist. That's one of my day jobs, and I also teach college psychology classes. And a few years ago, I had started writing articles for the web sort of as a hobby that later turned into a part-time position, and it's gone on to lead to wonderful opportunities where I've started writing for places like Forbes and Psychology Today, and then I'm really excited because a few months ago I was able to publish my first book, which was an incredible opportunity. And I also do speaking engagements now and get to travel all about the world talking to people about mental strength. And so that's a huge accomplishment for me to be able to talk to people about all the things that can help them become mentally strong. It's something that I used to do in an office setting on a one-on-one basis, and I'm thrilled now to be able to be helping people all over the world. My book's going to be published in, I think we're up to 23 languages, so I'm super excited about that as well.
That is awesome. When did the book come out?
It hit the shelves in the U.S. on December 23rd. So it's been out for just a couple of months.
Just a couple months, and you're already over 20 languages. That's pretty sweet.
Yes, I think so.
and the name of the book here is 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. Take back your power, embrace change, face your fears, and train your brain for happiness and success. How long did it take you to write?
I think it was March when I got my signed contract from HarperCollins, and the book was due in June. So I wrote it fast and furious, but fortunately it's things that, I inherently knew and things I'd been working on with in my therapy office for years. So it was able to come to me quickly.
Just kind of flowed. You sat down and there it came. So,
right.
How long have you been practicing?
2002 was when I first became a therapist.
And so this is pretty exciting for you, like you were saying, going from, sitting one-on-one with somebody in your office to being on stage and having this huge platform. How's that feel, going from one to the other?
Oh, it's definitely exciting, to be able to reach new levels of people, maybe people that aren't anybody that would normally go to therapy or people that aren't looking for that one-on-one work with the therapist, but a lot of the times it's the same sort of principles. So to be able to share them with people who are looking to grow their business or to figure out how do you take your job to the next level, those sorts of things. And they apply many of the same skills that people in my therapy office were using too. So it's really exciting to see the different ways that people use those exact same skills, but to have completely different goals, and it helps them reach those new levels of success. It's really exciting.
So you wrote this original article, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do. How did that article come about? What prompted you to write it?
Yeah, I was in it was actually a personal article for myself. I was in a place in my life where I needed a reminder of all the things not to do. In 2003, shortly after I had started working as a therapist, my mother had passed away suddenly from a brain aneurysm. And very quickly, I had to figure out, how do I work as a therapist helping other people deal with their problems while I'm privately dealing with my own grief? And that was sort of when my interest in mental strength became really personal. And if you fast forward, it was the 3-year anniversary of when my mother passed away that my 26-year-old husband died of a heart attack. And again, had to figure out, how do I deal with this immense pain and grief while still having to work as a therapist? You know, I don't have a trust fund or anything. I'm not wealthy. So I had to go to work. And so to figure out, how do I sit in an office all day helping other people deal with their problems while dealing with my own issues very privately? And so it took a lot of work to figure out, how do you build the mental strength to deal with all of that? And if you fast forward a few more years, my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And unlike when I lost my mother and my husband, this time I knew what was coming. I'd lost both of them in these very sudden and unexpected circumstances. But this time we knew that my father-in-law may have a couple of months left to live. And so I was faced with this dread of, oh my goodness, you know, I don't want to go through all this all over again. And so I sat down and I wrote this list as a reminder to myself of all the things I couldn't do if I wanted to face my circumstances with as much courage and strength as I knew I was going to need. And so I wrote this list and I thought, you know, we'll see if it helps anybody else. And I published it to the web. And within a matter of a couple of days, it had been viewed by millions and millions of people. And then somebody from Forbes emailed me and said, Forbes is picking up your article as well. And within a couple of days on Forbes, it had reached millions of people and suddenly became one of their most read articles ever, which then led to all sorts of exciting opportunities. You know, I was on Fox Business and Forbes did an on-camera interview and all sorts of things. But nobody knew that privately my grief was still unfolding. Nobody really knew the story of why I wrote it. They just assumed I had written it for the web. And so it was just a couple of days after my father-in-law passed away. I was on the news and people were, you know, asking me all these questions about mental strength. And I really didn't come forward with my story at the time because my family needed to be able to deal with their grief privately. And so it wasn't until much later that really the whole story came out. But in the midst of all that as well, I had gotten a call from a literary agent who said, I think this really needs to be turned into a book. And so within a very short amount of time, we put together a book proposal and we're fortunate enough to get multiple offers from different publishers and we're able to partner with HarperCollins to turn that article into a book.
That's like a total whirlwind within such a short amount of time. I mean, so from the time that your mom, you lost your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then your husband died at the age of 26 of a heart attack, which is crazy right there.
Right.
And then your father-in-law getting cancer and going through that whole thing. How much time had gone by?
It was about almost 10 years between the, when my mother passed away and when my father-in-law passed away.
So there's this dark decade of tragedy of things going on in your life. You're trying to hold it together as you're working and helping other people. You know, what were some of the things going on inside your head when you were trying to help others, but dealing with, you know, the things in your own life?
Yeah, it was really, you know, to be able to go into the office every day to figure out, how do I set some of my own pain aside temporarily so that I can, you know, be present with people. So I'm not, you know, worried about what's going on in my life and stuck, because, you know, I knew I wouldn't be effective as a therapist if I couldn't set some of those feelings aside, at least temporarily. But then when I got home at the end of the day, I knew I then needed to deal with all those emotions, because if I didn't, it was just going to delay my grief and cause lots more problems down the road. And, you know, grief is really the process by which we heal, and you got to go through it even though it's painful. And so to figure out sort of the balance of, how do I set those feelings aside by day so I can help other people, but then by night to be able to sort of immerse myself in this, in the pain, and allow myself to feel those emotions. And it was tricky at times to be able to do that, and then to still say, okay, and how do I, after my husband passed away, how do you build a new life, and how do I go about figuring out what are still my goals in life, and what things do I still want to pursue, but also what things do I not want to do, you know, the goals that he and I had together that maybe weren't going to be my goals anymore, and to figure all that out was, it was exhausting. And it felt like, you know, every time in life when I just start to feel like, okay, I can do this and I'm picking up the pieces and life is going forward and things are looking good, it just seemed like, you know, the other shoe would drop and another thing happened. And it's feel like, okay, I got to do this all over again. And it was definitely hard to do. And, you know, after a while, I started thinking things like, you know, gosh, you know, why doesn't anybody else ever lose people that they love? And why does it have to be me? And that was really in the place where I was when I wrote this list, because I could have very easily felt sorry for myself. And I had to remind myself that, you know, despite my problems, I'm very fortunate to have had these people in my life, even though it wasn't as long as I would have wished, but how fortunate I was, and to really change my thinking, to remind myself to be grateful rather than to feel sorry for myself. And that's really why not the number one thing on my list was to not feel sorry for myself. Because again, it was in a place in my life where I needed that reminder that, you know, despite my circumstances, there's definitely plenty of people who have things far worse than I do, and that I still had a lot to be grateful for.
Well, there's that, isn't there that balance of, okay, yeah, I understand there are people that have it far worse than I do, but you can't just blow that off, because whatever you're dealing with is totally real to you and sucks, right?
Right. And so to figure out, you know, to acknowledge that it's okay to feel sad and it's okay to feel bad that all these things happen, but at the same time to balance that out with, and I still have food to eat and a roof over my head. And, you know, I'd hear stories too of people that had lost a loved one, if they lost their partner and they didn't have enough money to figure out how they were going to live. Well, fortunately, I didn't have that problem. I wasn't going to be homeless or out on the street or anything like that because I had a job. But often people who, if they were a stay-at-home parent or something and they lose their partner who, and that was their only source of income, they have another whole new set of problems. And fortunate for me, I had a job, so I knew, okay, I can eat, I can keep a roof over my head, and I don't have to worry about my basic needs. I can just focus on how do I get better.
So I want to, since this is obviously a podcast, people probably are on a mobile device and they're in their car, on the train, walking, whatever they're doing. I want to just quickly read down the list of the 13 things, and then I want to just ask you a couple questions about them, if that's cool.
Sure, absolutely.
So they can kind of hear what we're talking about. The first thing you said was they don't waste time feeling sorry for themselves. Number two, they don't give away their power. Three, they don't shy away from change. Four, they don't waste energy on things they can't control. Number five, they don't worry about pleasing everyone. Number six, they don't fear taking calculated risks. Seven, they don't dwell on the past. Eight, they don't make the same mistakes over and over. Nine, they don't resent other people's success. 10, they don't give up after the first failure. 11, they don't fear alone time. 12, they don't feel the world owes them anything. And 13, they don't expect immediate results. And so there's a couple that jumped out at me when I first read the list and some of your commentary on those on your website and in the article. You know, we're about a year removed from when you wrote this, roughly?
Yeah, it was November 20 of 13 when I wrote my original list.
So about a year and a half. Would you revise any of it?
You know, I don't think I would. I really have, you know, as I was writing the book and everything, I still stuck with this list. And I thought, you know, these are the thoughts, the behaviors, and the feelings that can hold us back. And even though I wrote my list, you know, sort of in this moment of passion for myself, it was the things that I inherently knew that when clients would come in my office, the ones that got better the fastest didn't do these things. And so in putting together my list, I think it was always just in the back of my head. I just never written it all down in one place.
Okay. Now, out of these 13, do any of these stand out to you as way more common than other things?
Well, it's interesting because I'll ask people, you know, which one of these do you think is the most common? And I almost always get completely different answers from people. And so that's pretty fascinating to me that, you know, some people will say, well, we don't learn from our mistakes. And somebody else will say, well, we all shy away from change. And so it's fascinating to me that I think we all have these notions of, well, if I do this, everybody else must do it too. And But often I think everybody sort of has their Achilles heel. And so when people read my list or talk about my book, they'll say, you know, I've got a couple of these covered, a couple of them, you know, I'm so on. But then there's a few that those are the two or three things that really hold me back or that I struggle with the most.
Yeah, I think the one that jumped out at me, and maybe it's just a timing thing, you know, what's going on in your life at the time when you read this list. But for me, the thing that jumped out the most was number four, they don't waste energy on things they can't control. And I've been really mindful of that, it seems, over the last couple months where, you know, I'm blown away by how much energy I'll give to something that I literally have no say over. And in fact, even, you know, you and I, before we hit record today, I was telling you, I came back in town a couple days ago, I was out of town and they lost our luggage. And I remember reading on your list, you made reference to, hey, if they lose your luggage, you know, what are you going to do? You know? And so it was funny because I was annoyed. I was tired. And then I quickly gathered myself, you know, again, not like this was a tragedy, but it was like, I just gathered myself, said, you know what? It's luggage. You know, it's in Texas and I'm in Illinois and it'll get here when it gets here, you know, and I moved on and it was, so anyway, that jumped out at me. And so let me ask you this, if you wouldn't mind, what, would you mind sharing which of these 13 you struggle the most with?
You know, I think it certainly depends on where I am in my life. And when I wrote the list, it was that self-pity one, number one on the list. But, you know, I think at other times it all sort of depends. And I think often I'll think, well, you know, I've got that one under control. But if I had to pick the one that maybe I struggle with the most, probably, boy, that's a tough one. But sometimes calculated risk for me is tough. When it comes to really sitting down to think about taking a calculated risk, sometimes it's anxiety provoking. You start thinking about the pros and the cons, or you think, should I do this or shouldn't I? And I'll, rather than really focus on calculating the risk, I'll just want to either jump in and say, well, I'll just do it and see what happens. Or I'll say, you know, I don't want to deal with that. And I avoid it. And so for me, that one can be a tough one, whether it's, you know, doing something with money, or if it's doing something with my career, to figure out, all right, what's the next step? And do I want to take that step or not? And to remind myself that, you know, the emotions involved aren't always logical. And that just because something feels scary doesn't mean it's a bad idea, because our emotions aren't always logical or dependable. And so to raise my logic by figuring out what's the real pros and cons and what's the real level of risk, and it usually has nothing to do with my level of fear. But to be able to do that really causes me to confront whatever risk it is I'm looking at, and to, which is anxiety provoking. And, you know, we like to avoid anxiety by nature. And so to figure out, okay, what can I do? And then once you make a decision of, oh, okay, well, this is only mildly risky, even though it feels really scary, then it's much easier to move forward.
Yeah. What's the worst thing that could happen? Right. So it's
exactly.
So mental strength, how would you define it?
It's got three parts to it. The first one is that it's about regulating your thoughts. Often our thoughts are not accurate, and we exaggerate things, or we tend to dwell on the negative. And so to be mentally strong, you really have to figure out, well, what's the truth here? And the second part is our emotions. And it's really being in control of our emotions so that our emotions don't control us. And then the third part is our behavior. And it's all about making a choice to behave productively despite whatever circumstances you find yourself in. And all three of those things are related. If you want to change how you feel, you can change how you think or change how you behave. And when you do one of those things differently, they all influence one another. And so if you start thinking differently, you'll feel differently. And if you start behaving differently, then you'll start to see things differently. And so sometimes we have to behave contrary to how we feel, or we have to really look at a situation, force ourselves to think about something differently. If we say, you know, I always mess up on everything I do. Well, that's not true. So you have to remind yourself of times when you've succeeded, and then it can help you to create a more balanced outlook. So it's really requires you to do those three things and to do them consistently. But the more that you practice, the stronger you can become. And just like when it comes to physical strength, that you can't just say, well, I'm strong enough and I don't need to do anything, because your muscles would start to waste away after a while. And mental strength is the same. You really have to practice and say, I'm going to devote time to becoming stronger. And people will often ask me, well, why would you want to talk about what mentally strong people don't do? And I tell them again, it's like physical strength. And you'd need good habits like going to the gym if you wanted to become physically stronger. But you also have to give up your bad habits like eating too much junk food. And mental strength, you need to have good habits, which I think a lot of us know inherently what sort of good habits we need to have. But we often don't talk about those bad habits. And sometimes our bad habits can be counterproductive to our good habits. And so I really want people to focus on, how do I give up the bad habits that are holding me back? And those 13 things on my list are all about the thoughts, behaviors, and feelings that can hold us back. And if you're doing them right alongside your good habits, you're sort of like the hamster running in a wheel and you don't make any progress. But by giving them up, you can become so much stronger and you can move forward and reach your goals so much faster. And so it's really about figuring out, what are my good habits, but also what are the bad habits I need to give up to become a stronger person?
Is mental strength the same as emotional intelligence?
You know, I don't think it is. Of course, emotional intelligence, there's been so many different authors and so many different speakers and different people that talk about it, that it people discuss it in different ways. But I think mental strength, again, really just encompasses the thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And it depends on who you ask about emotional intelligence, what sort of things it encompasses and doesn't encompass. And I think, you know, mental strength incorporates some degree of emotional intelligence. You need to be aware of your own emotions, but emotional intelligence usually also focuses more on the social skills and the social communication and those sorts of things, which I think are important. But I think to just focus on what you can control, which is yourself, and to take personal responsibility and to want to do exercises to become stronger, that you can do that when, you know, there's all sorts of debates about emotional intelligence and what that means and that sort of thing. But I think mental strength in its simplest form is really just about your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors and the choices that you make every day.
All right. So walk me through an example where, you know, you realize that you're going down the path of one of these 13 things. How do you exercise yourself into being stronger mentally? What does that look like?
Sure. So for instance, number 5 on my list is that mentally strong people don't worry about pleasing everyone. And for people that are people pleasers, you know, they often will say yes to everything that anyone asks them to do. And then they end up being resentful towards that person later on. And so one of the exercises is to first recognize that you do say yes to things you don't want to do, or things that go against your values, or things that you'll later be resentful about. And it's a matter of practicing saying no. And for some people, it's just a matter of whenever somebody asks them a question, to be able to say, I'll have to check my schedule and get back to you, just to buy them some time, because they're so used to saying yes that it's sort of ingrained that whenever anybody asks them something, they just say yes, yes, yes. And so their exercise becomes saying, you know, I'm going to check my schedule and get back to you, and then to wait at least an hour before you give somebody an answer. Because it gives you enough time to think about, is this something I really want to do or not? And then if you decide, you know, hey, I don't mind helping that person, whether it's move furniture or volunteer work at the school for a day or something like that, then, oh, okay, I'll go ahead and do it. But if they then realize, you know, gee, I'd rather hang out with my family on Saturday than go do that, then they can call back and say, you know, I don't think that's something I'm able to do. And the other thing is, with people who tend to be people pleasers, is they often feel like they need an excuse. And they can't come up with excuses fast enough to say, no, I can't do that because. And so the trick becomes just being able to say, no, I'm sorry, I'm not able to do that. And you don't have to offer a reason why. You can just say no.
I was going to ask you that, because sometimes it's like, no, I just don't want to.
Right. And that's completely okay. And for people who are used to pleasing others, that's extremely uncomfortable, because they're worried, what if this person gets mad at me, or what if they don't like me anymore? What if they think I'm selfish? And so for them, it's about practicing tolerating that feeling and that sort of uncertainty of, you know, is this person ever going to speak to me again? Because their thoughts tend to be all about, oh no, people should like me. And if they don't, it'll be horrible and disastrous and awful. And so to practice saying no, and to practice setting healthy limits, and to remind yourself of all the things you'll gain in life by not trying to please people. And often that's one of the keys to contentment in life, because people who are people pleasers will do things that don't go along with their values. Not that they necessarily do anything incredibly unethical or immoral, but somebody might say, boy, I really value my family, but then they're off always doing favors for neighbors and cousins and whomever else, and they don't spend any time with their partner or their kids. And then you ask them about that and they'll be like, well, because they're the most forgiving of all, you know, I'm willing to offend them or something like that. But it really doesn't go along with what the values they have in life. So to be able to figure out, how do you live according to your values? And even though it might be uncomfortable in the moment to say no to people, in the long run, you'll be much more content and you'll be able to be bold and courageous and do those things you want to do in life that are according to your values. And the side effect of that is you'll be a much happier and more content person overall.
So I imagine that one of the biggest factors to somebody becoming mentally strong is first realizing that they're not.
Right.
Being aware that there even is a problem. What are some things that you can tell us about how to spot when you're being a mental weakling?
Well, you know, and I think that that's absolutely right. Plenty of people have said, well, I don't really need your book because I'm mentally strong. And that may be true. I think that we all possess certain strengths and it's a continuum, but it would sort of be like saying, you know, I never need to lift weights because I'm already physically strong. Well, that wouldn't make sense, right? If you wanted to stay physically strong, you'd still need to work out. And I think at different points in our lives, sort of things come easy. Like it's easy to be happy for other people around you who are successful when you're also successful. But if you lose your job or you take a major financial hit, it then becomes much more difficult to not resent other people's success. So if that's not something you've ever addressed in your life, that suddenly can become a major problem. And so I think for people to really take an honest look at their bad habits and say, well, what kinds of things might be holding me back? And I think everybody could think of examples of certain times when they've, say, shied away from change or when they've dwelled on the past, and sort of figure out, how do I stop letting those certain things bother me? But also, your life isn't going to stay the same whether you want it to change or not. It's going to change, and we're all going to face tragedy and problems and challenges in life. So what can you do to prepare for the very best that you can so that when you encounter more problems in life that you'll be ready? And, you know, it certainly requires a bit of humility to say, I can become better, but to be able to just acknowledge, I can be a better person, I can grow stronger, I can take steps to better myself, both personally and professionally. And I think just admitting that alone is a sure sign that you are somebody who wants to become even stronger than you are now. And I don't think that there's ever a top limit. I think about the time we think, oh, I'm strong enough, it's a sure sign that we aren't doing the things we could be to become even stronger, and that our mental muscles can sort of start to waste away after a while. So I think it's always a work in progress and always something we can choose to make a priority in our life, no matter how good we might think that we're doing.
Is there something that people often mistake for mental strength?
Yeah, sometimes people think that it's about acting tough, and they'll say, well, you know, I don't cry, or I don't care how other people feel, something like that. And that's really not about being strong, because I think to be mentally strong, you need to be aware of your emotions. And so to just ignore them and claim that you don't ever feel emotions is just plain crazy. But I think that's often, or people will say, well, you know, I don't want to be like a robot. Well, I completely agree. We don't want to turn anybody into a robot. That we want you to be in touch with your feelings, though, and to be able to acknowledge how you feel. And it's not about ignoring them or suppressing them or pretending that they don't exist, but instead to be fully aware of how you feel and then acknowledge, okay, sometimes I can behave contrary to that, and that's okay. But I think that's the biggest one, is that people seem to just confuse acting tough or mean or bossy, those sorts of things, for being mentally strong. And they're not the same thing.
Well, that one resonates with me when you said that. I mean, I'm a Marine. You know, I spent years in the Marine Corps. I'm a football coach. You know, there's
right,
and it's very easy for me to have this mentality of just gut through it.
Yep.
Don't give my emotions a second thought because there's a job to do. And when I heard you answer the difference between, you know, that mental strength and mental toughness, it really, really makes sense because I'm 45 years old and I feel in some ways I'm just starting to figure out what it truly means to be mentally strong. And take it to a deeper level other than just being mentally tough, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, I think so. And, you know, and I think to be tough serves a purpose, right? If you're in combat as a Marine, we don't really want you to be thinking about your emotions at the moment. You got to get through it. And so that often that toughness does serve purposes in life, but over the long haul, to be strong is different than to just be tough. And to be tough can get you through in the moment, but if you want to experience the positive side effects of being strong, you have to make that shift. And I do think for men especially, to acknowledge their weaknesses and to say, okay, it's not just about being tough, but to be in touch with my emotions is a completely different thing than we often teach. And as a society, we don't spend much time talking about feelings or talking about anything that has to do with the psychology of our brain other than maybe success or something like that. But mental health, mental illness, those sorts of things aren't things that we enjoy talking about. And we usually don't discuss those things. So to be able to talk about mental strength, I think is something that I'm thrilled people are now talking about, because I think it's a discussion that we need to have more often.
What do you say to the person who says, I don't know what I'm feeling?
Well, I think it's, you know, probably more proof that they need to work on that too. Sometimes it's just a matter of identifying feelings. If you ask a lot of adults to name as many feeling words as they could in 60 seconds, they'll say, you know, mad, sad, and happy. And then they kind of like, after that, because we don't use feeling words in our everyday conversation. And sort of sometimes looking at a list of feeling words and sort of thinking, oh, okay, there are more than just three or four emotions. There's hundreds of emotions. And how do I know? Or when's a time when I felt that particular one? And with practice, we can all become better at pinpointing our emotions and how those emotions change all throughout that. Every hour of every day, we feel lots of different things. And so to figure out, how do you begin to identify it? And if you're not used to doing that, it takes practice for sure.
Mm-hmm. So number two on your list is they don't give away their power. Talk to me a little bit about that. That intrigues me.
Yeah, often people will do things like say, you know, my mother-in-law makes me feel bad about myself because she's really critical, or something along those lines, which is all about sort of giving other people the power over how you feel. And so to recognize other people can influence how you feel, but they can't make you feel anything. And so just acknowledging that can go a long way. And also that one is about acknowledging that other people don't force you to do anything. So somebody might say, my boss makes me work late and I don't like it. Well, maybe there's consequence if you don't work late. Perhaps your job will be in jeopardy, but you're not forced to work late. And so sometimes it's just a matter of recognizing that you have a choice in the matter. And so to be able to say, all right, I don't want to work late, but I'm choosing to, because otherwise, you know, I don't want to get in trouble at work. But to not blame other people for the way that you think or feel or behave. And sometimes just changing your language can be hugely empowering and can make people recognize, oh, okay, every day I have thousands of choices I make. And we really don't think about the choices. A lot of them are just second nature to us because we do the same thing every single day over and over again. And so to remind ourselves, I'm choosing to do all of these things. And I have an immense amount of choices of how I want to spend my time, who I want to be around, and how I want to live my life. And that can be a major sort of hurdle for people to get over. And once they get over that hurdle of realizing, you know, I'm in control of my own life, it can open lots of new doors and opportunities for people as they make choices about how to move forward.
It reminds me of when my kids were younger and they would be at preschool and stuff. They'd come back and we were teaching them, "I'm the boss of me," you know.
Right.
You know that I get to choose what I do.
Right. So, your brother didn't make you mad and make you hit him. You chose to do that. And so I think we do with little kids. We'll often do that. And then as we grow older, sometimes it like message gets lost on ourselves. We feel like, no, I have to do that. But, you know, as an adult who lives in a free world, there's very few things in life that we have to do. Otherwise, it's just all the choices that we make.
So you're writing for Forbes. You're kind of messing around in the business world now and entrepreneurship and things like that. Does anything on this list jump out at you that most often knocks the typical entrepreneur off track?
Good question. I guess a couple of them do, but if I had to pick one, probably be the failure one, that mentally strong people don't give up after their first failure. And I think often I'll hear entrepreneurs say things like, well, you know, that wasn't meant to be. I tried to open a business. It didn't work out. So perhaps, you know, I'm not really a business minded person, or perhaps that's not anything I was meant to do. And they'll go back to their 9-to-5 job and hate it because they had this one failed business attempt or because their business wasn't as successful as they'd wanted it to be. Then it sort of changes their beliefs about themselves, where they decide, I'm not good enough and I can't do that. And rather than being willing to keep going. And so to figure out, when you fail at something, how do you learn from it and how do you move forward in a way that failure makes you better rather than holds you back? And we all have opportunities to learn from our failure if we're willing to really take a moment to examine it and to be able to look at our attempts at something as more of a marathon rather than a sprint, so that when you hit a stumbling block, to know that that doesn't mean it's necessarily the end of the road, but instead it's just a challenge to overcome, or we need to find a new way of trying something or doing something, and how do you get around it? And I would say that's the biggest thing I hear from entrepreneurs, is that often people will dabble in something on the side for a while before they try to quit their day job. But if they don't get the results that they wanted right off, then they say, well, that didn't work out. And they're quick to throw in the towel. So to figure out, when you do fail at something, how do you go around it? How do you keep going forward, and to know that failure can make you better rather than change the way that you view yourself?
So yeah, number 10 is they don't give up after the first failure, and 13 is they don't expect immediate results. Those are super similar.
Yeah, and our digital world certainly, you know, makes it so we get most things at a touch of a button. They're in an instant. And so to know that in real life, a lot of things, whether it's personal growth or growing a business, that, you know, it's not going to be an overnight success and that it takes time. But I think we're now becoming even more ingrained than ever that things should happen fast. And if it's not happening fast enough, then it's not happening at all. And to be able to figure out, how do you judge your progress and how do you evaluate what your goals are, and to know that you're moving forward. And even if you're only moving at a snail's pace, as long as you're headed in the right direction, that's good. But I think we're, as a society these days, we're impatient and we love it when things happen fast, and we assume we should be an overnight success. And if we're not, then we just throw in the towel. So they are definitely related when it comes to the business world of how do you accept that you might fail, but how do you also accept that it's probably not going to be next week or next month that you hit it big? It's going to take a long time to grow and to get there.
Do you have any advice for entrepreneurs who maybe they've been slugging away for a while and they're not feeling successful? Like how to reframe that? How to define success? Any tips for them on that so that they can have a healthier version or view of it?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. The first one is to know, to have a solid definition of success, because often we look towards our competition or we look around and say, well, that person's doing this, so that means they're successful, which then means I'm not. So do you know, what is your definition of success? Do you want to make enough money to be able to live comfortably? Do you want to make enough money that you can, you know, retire early? Or do you just want to have a business that really, you know, helps people or serves a purpose? And to write down your definition of success so that when you start to veer off or think about, you know, am I doing things right? You can go back to what your definition of success was, and to know that according to your definition, you may not be able to do all the things that everybody else is doing, but that's okay. That's their goal. And to let them have their goal and their definition of success, and to know that that's separate from your definition. And the second thing is to figure out, okay, how do I judge my progress towards my goal of success? Because sometimes progress isn't always in a straight line. Two steps forward, one step back, and that's if you're lucky. And sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. An example I use with that is I often teach parenting classes. And one of the things we talk about in our parenting class is for parents to ignore these temper tantrums with their preschoolers and toddlers. Because kids want your attention and they want you to give in. And so I'll talk to parents about, you know, look the other way, pretend you don't hear it, and just ignore it altogether. And parents will often come back the next week and say, well, that didn't work because he just started screaming louder. And my message to them is, well, it did work because you're now bothering him that you're ignoring him. So he's upping his game. And so by him getting worse and showing you that that bothers him, it actually means your ignoring is really effective. But because we often do that in business too, where we don't recognize progress when it's right there in front of us. So to know, okay, maybe my bank account has to go down before it's going to go up, or maybe I have to, you know, hit these stumbling blocks first, but then if I can get through them, I'll be much better. Better than before. And so to sort of figure out, well, what does progress look like? How am I going to know if I'm making progress? And what are some signs that maybe I'm still headed in the right direction, but it's just not as fast as I want? And to really think about what are the things I need to see in order to know, what are the milestones I want to hit? And rather than saying, you know, I need to earn $1 million, let's start with $100 and just focus on small steps. Because I think too often we really focus on the one big dream or that huge goal down the road. And then we give up, or we think, oh, I'm never going to get there. And we're tempted to throw in the towel, sort of really break it down into much smaller chunks, and then to celebrate when you hit these mini milestones too. So to know, okay, you don't have to wait till you hit that huge goal in order to feel like a success. You can celebrate those little successes along the way and reinforce to yourself that, yeah, I'm doing the right thing and this is hard, and but I'm going to keep going. And so sometimes just honoring yourself and your hard work along the way can help you to stay motivated to keep moving forward too.
It sounds so much about having some an evaluation process of your success that's not tied to your emotion.
Right. And that's exactly it, to be able to have more of a concrete method of saying, okay, what are the things I need to do? Because there will be days where we all feel like, you know, I'm a failure, I'm not doing things good enough. And what can you do to counteract those feelings, to remind yourself, you know, we make our best decisions when our emotion and our logic are in check. So sometimes you need a written reminder that you can read over that will raise your logic and sort of balance out those emotions when they're on the negative side.
So Amy, how have you changed since the original article has come out?
Oh, good question. You know, I think in a few ways I've changed. Obviously, I'm still the same me, but it certainly has given me, on a practical level, new platforms and new opportunities to go out and to try new things. And, you know, as a therapist who worked in one-on-one in an office setting, to now be able to go out and talk to so many more people in these group settings and things is exciting. And it certainly boosted my confidence and my ability to talk about mental strength, and that people are certainly interested in it, and that I can go out and, you know, travel the world and talk to big companies and interesting organizations and that people are interested in it. So every time I'm able to do that, it certainly reinforces to me, okay, I'm on the right track and I'm making progress towards my goals to be able to spread this message. And then, you know, also on a practical level, I've certainly cut back on my therapy practice because there just aren't enough hours in the day to be able to do all of these things plus work as a therapist. So it's changed my schedule. And I do a lot more writing, and I think I'm probably more more bold and more apt to take bigger risks now because, you know, if I talk to people that maybe are celebrities or major magazines and those sorts of things in the past, I would have thought, oh, gee, I don't know that they'll listen to little old me. But every time I get more proof that people are interested in this, it just propels me forward to say, hey, you know, and just to last month, we got an excerpt from my book. Oprah was interested in it, and so they put an excerpt on her website, which I think is a wonderful thing. And awesome, I hold man. Right. And so, you know, and also as a social worker, I hold the record of being the only social worker that has ever been on Glenn Beck's TV show, and I've been on it twice. And so to just be able to go out and do these new things is, to me, is just so exciting. So I think also now I wake up and I'm just thrilled for my feet to hit the floor and to get to work and to find out where the day is going to bring me.
Man, that's so exciting. I mean, just in a year and a half.
Right. Yeah. You things know, change how fast.
And that should be really encouraging to people that might be listening that feel like they're getting the crap beat out of them in life, that, you know, things can turn pretty quickly.
Right. We never know sort of what's going to be around the next corner, but to just keep going and things can definitely change.
I love it. I got one more question for you. For the people that are listening that are wanting to develop and build their own mental strength, what are, I don't know, 2-3 things that someone can do right now to start building that mental strength? What are some real practical things they can start today?
Yeah, you know, one of the most basic things is gratitude. And we know that just changing the way that we think about things and recognizing what we have to be grateful for can make all sorts of shifts in our brain and in our behavior and in the way we feel. So to start a gratitude journal, even if you're not into journaling all the time, but to just write down one thing every day that you have to be grateful for, whether it be that the sun was shining or that you had some new shoes to wear to work, whatever it might be, but just one thing that you're grateful for can help make that shift, and it changes the way that you think, and eventually your brain will start to look for things to be grateful for rather than to focus on the negative. So that's one simple thing anybody can start doing today. And then another one, let's see, another easy one that people could do would be to spend maybe a couple of minutes a day learning something that would be a quiet activity for ourselves to do. So often in life, we have so much social noise and so much going on, and we're running from one activity to the next. So whether it be meditation or mindfulness, or even just taking 5 minutes a day to unplug and turn everything off and to just focus on your goals and your progress and how you're doing in life, and to be willing to check in with yourself. It's hard to do for a lot of people who are so used to the hustle and bustle, but that can be another thing that just really gives us more self-awareness and reminds us of who we are, where we're going, and where we want to be. And that can make all the difference in the world to how much energy we have and how we feel about ourselves. So I think that would be my second major tip, is to just take time out and really enjoy figuring out how am I doing in life and where do I go from here.
All right, I lied. I have one more question, because you made me think of something. Do we have a limited amount of mental strength each day?
Well, you know, I think we have a limited amount of mental energy each day. Mm-hmm. And so the trick is to use it wisely, because otherwise there's certain tasks that will drain our mental energy and to suck it all up. And so to figure out how do I use it. But I think that we have unlimited potential to always grow better.
That's good stuff. Amy, thank you for hanging out with us today. If people want to reach out to you, what's the best way for them to do that? If somebody wants to have you come speak, anything like that, how do they find you?
My website is Amy Morin, M-O-R-I-N, and then it's LCSW, as in Licensed Clinical Social Worker, .com.
Awesome. And they can reach out to you through there, and they can also buy the book on your website.
Yep, my book's for sale in all the major bookstores and Target, and of course Amazon, and my website lists all the places where they can find it as well.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you again for hanging out with me today and for adding some good stuff to our listeners today about becoming more mentally strong. So again, thank you so much, Amy, for being our guest. And everybody, please take some time, check out Amy's website. A link will be in the show notes. Go buy the book. If you have a organization that needs a speaker to come in that can really help your people, then consider bringing Amy in and talk about how to be mentally strong. So again, Amy, thanks so much. And everybody, we'll see you next time on the Strongpreneur Podcast.